Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
8 days to go. And for apparently 15 or 20% of the electorate, already a done deal. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, which I want to get into in some more detail a little later on today. By the way, Ralph Nader will be with us in the 11:30 Eastern hour. The 11:30 Pacific hour. It'll be the 2:30 Eastern hour. Kerry Lucas is going to drop by beginning of the next hour, the Vice President for Public Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum. We're seeing the right-wing media machine really kick into high gear. I was on Fox News this morning with Bill and Megan. And they were reporting on Acorn. Acorn is registering people to vote. Well, actually, Acorn is not registering people to vote. Secretaries of state's offices register people to vote. Acorn is submitting potential registrations, which Secretary of State's offices can accept or reject, and many of them are being rejected, not unreasonably. But the fact of the matter is that in the 2004 election, 3 million votes were not counted. 3 million people showed up to vote, 3 million people who believed that they were legally qualified to vote and registered, and their votes did not get counted. This year, it'll probably be 6 or 7 million. The New York Times reporting in the eight major swing states, millions of people have been illegally removed from the voter rolls. No discussion of that, of course, over on Fox News. And now it's all about the redistribution of wealth. We have this audio of Barack Obama in 2001 being on WBEZ, I believe it is, the public radio station in Chicago, talking about the Dred Scott decision and the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, the 1854 and the 1896, if I'm remembering my years right, Supreme Court decisions that Dred Scott led right to the Civil War that said African Americans have no rights, the one in 1896 saying segregation was legal, establishing legal apartheid in the United States, and talking about the economic consequences of that. And, oh, my God, he used the phrase redistribution of wealth. The right wing is hysterical. Let's bring on Brad O'Leary. Brad is the president of ATI News, chairman of the board of PM Direct, former president of the American Association of Political Consultants, the author of a newly released book, Attacking Barack Obama, the website barackobamatest.com, the book, The Audacity of Deceit. Hey, Brad, welcome to the show.
Good to be back. I'm delighted you're having me back.
Well,
I always enjoy a good argument.
Me too. I'm wondering how you guys are going to handle this. Are you going to defend the concentration of wealth? We have right now in the United States the top 1% of wealth in the top 1% of people in terms of ownership of wealth own more wealth than the bottom 90% of Americans. The top 1% of wage earners earn more wages than the bottom 50% of Americans. And it sounds to me like the McCain campaign is going to go into the last days defending the ongoing concentration of wealth. Do I have that right?
I think what you're defending is whether we want to turn our society in one that would use wealth to create jobs or use wealth just to take care of people.
How does wealth create jobs, Brad?
Well, I'm a businessman. I've created four companies, and the total number of people I've employed, and these are all from zero. I never inherited a company. But over the years, I've employed over 1,000 people.
Now, did you ever employ any of those people just because you had some extra money in your pocket?
Sure.
No. Come on, Brad. You're not that stupid.
Wait a minute.
I would submit to you that you employed all those people, just like I've employed several hundred people in my lifetime, because each one of those people would work for less than the amount of money that I could make from their work. Is that not an accurate statement?
I think that's an accurate statement, but you also employ people for the idea that you're going to grow. So you employ people that you really don't need with the idea that a month from now you may need them as your business grows.
Bill, if you run businesses where you hire people that you don't need and who aren't making money for your business is going to die.
Well, my business has never died, and what I anticipated was growth. I knew that if I signed up a client or did something for someone, and I didn't have the right kind of personnel to service that client, they wouldn't be with me very long.
Well, if you have a reasonable assumption that you're going to get a contract, I mean,
if I
know that I'm going to pick up, you know, some of our clients when we had an ad agency in Atlanta were, you know, Sony, American Express, Serta, Holiday Inns of America. I mean, we did all of their publications for years. And you know, if I was going to get one of those clients, then I would be sure that I had people lined up, but I wouldn't necessarily have them on the payroll. The bottom line here is that demand is what drives businesses. Demand, not supply. Just because, and so if I had, you know, if my company was making money and I was making money and I got a tax cut, and I did a couple of times. In fact, under the Reagan administration, I got a pretty enormous tax cut. And at one point, I got such a large capital gains tax cut that I sold a business to take advantage of it. That did not cause me to hire one single person. What it caused me to do was retire, take a year off, go to Europe with my family, live there, spend 3 years doing international relief work around the world. I didn't create a single job with that tax cut. That money.
I'm sure you gave money to organizations that were taking care of people.
So you're suggesting that America should become like Victorian England was, where only the very, very wealthy pass out money, and we should all be like Bob Cratchit. Please, Mr. Scrooge, will you provide health care to my tiny Tim? No, I won't, unless I have a change of heart. And then the angel comes, and he has a change of heart. Oh, yes, okay, now I'll give health care to tiny Tim. That's the America that you envision?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm an Irishman, and I would never envision copying anything from Great Britain, because they were probably the most cruel people in the world.
Then why are you advocating the Victorian system of economics? The Victorian system of economics was, if you're poor, tough luck, you're on your own, Charlie. And if you're rich, by the way, we're going to make sure that you keep those riches, and we're going to do everything we can to inhibit social mobility. In fact, England even had maximum wage laws to stop social mobility.
And look, we have wage laws that
are a joke.
Wait a minute. We have wage laws that try to take care of people without costing jobs. But more importantly than that, what I put in my book in September that is now part of the what everybody's arguing about, after the Wall Street Journal and Investors Daily certified what I was saying is correct, that Obama's tax plan will wind up with 44% of Americans who will never pay federal income tax as long as they live. Now, do you think
40% of American workers right now, Brad O'Leary, Barack Obama Test.com and The Audacity to Deceit, your book, we're talking with Brad O'Leary, 40%, according to the McCain campaign, 40% of American workers right now make such lousy, crappy wages, such you can't live on this wages, such you can't afford health care with these wages, that they don't pay income taxes. And for some reason that I don't understand, you and the McCain campaign are bragging about this. This is that Victorian England that you as an Irishman said you decry.
Well, I don't know what the McCain campaign's doing, because I haven't paid attention to it. But my book said that under Bush, it grew from 20% to 32%. Today, it's 32%, and our polling...
So the number of people who have slipped into poverty has gone up by more than half.
No, not slipped into poverty, but...
Well, made such lousy wages that they don't even pay income taxes.
We've increased deductions to the extent that 32% don't. And Obama's program of tax relief is not tax relief. It's getting money back. So 42% of Americans would not only not pay federal income tax, but those at the bottom level would be given money back. They'd be actually be getting checks from the federal government. Now, do you want half of the people in America to not pay for any kind of federal income tax?
I think a better way to do it, Brad, would be to make sure that their employers, by having strong minimum wage laws and higher minimum wage laws and more unions, make sure that their employers are paying them enough that they can live. But if we're going to allow the right-wingers to run this country in such a way that people are working 40, 50, 60 hours a week and they still can't afford health care, then, yeah, I think the rest of us should help them out.
Well, when you say afford health care, now...
$10,000 a year to a health insurance company.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm going in for prostate cancer surgery in November.
I'm sorry to hear that, Brett. I
well,
wish
no, I mean, everybody, every man over 50 has to face that.
Yeah.
And I'm doing it before there's a chance that Obama is elected, because if he's elected, the cost of it would be free, and I could wait. But I don't want to wait. I want it out, because the other thing that will happen with free medical care is you'll have the same system as Great Britain or Canada, where a government bureaucracy will decide whether a procedure or an operation is needed. And my doctor would not lie. He would say to them if they asked, Brad O'Leary could wait another 5 years.
Yeah.
And they would say, okay, in that case, come back in 5 years. He keeps the cancer in his body until it's serious.
Brad O'Leary is the author of The Audacity of Deceit, his website, BarackObamaTest.com. Brad, good luck on your surgery.
All right. Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for dropping by. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Fresh opinions and news you can use. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the No Boring Zone. Our program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. Okay, so I was on Fox News this morning. I just want to get this out of the way. Everybody was all hysterical about Joe Biden being interviewed by Barbara West on this WFTV, this TV station down in Florida, where she said, your socialist agenda and things like this. You know, she quoted Karl Marx at him. You know, Karl Marx said, according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And, isn't that social? Anyhow, the bottom line, number one, she was conflating communism with socialism, which is stupid. Marxism and communism. I made the point, I like my socialist police department, I like my socialist fire department, I like my socialist public streets with lights that work, red lights and green lights that actually work, and traffic laws that are enforced. I like the communist fire department, I like our communist public school, or socialist rather, public schools. I like the fact that there is a certain amount of socialism built into the American system. I think we need a little bit more of it, but not a lot more. I don't want the government involved in the means of production and supply. I don't want the government making my shoes. I don't want the government making my television or my computer. I do want the government caring for the commons. I want the government administering our public parks. I think the government should be involved. Local governments should be involved with local power and water and sanitation systems so that they're answerable to we the people. This is the stuff that's necessary for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To advocate this and to advocate the larger funding of this is not socialism. It is Americanism, frankly. And it's the way that all advanced countries work. Of course, the conservatives want to take us back from that. So, anyhow, and this host, Barbara West, with these questions and whatnot, it was just incredibly unprofessional of her. At the very least, she could have said, people are suggesting that you're a socialist. How do you respond? That would be the way that a journalist would do it. She did it like, a high school debate or something. I mean, it wasn't even good high school debating. It was just tragic. Now, At the Drudge Report, which Drudge is the assignment editor, of course, for all the right-wing radio shows, and so this is going to be the only thing you're going to hear about on right-wing talk radio today, is going off hysterically about this Barack Obama redistribution of wealth. They call it a bombshell. It's actually an interview on WBEZ-FM, the public station in Chicago, and I've listened to the whole thing. There's this long discussion of Dred Scott, the Supreme Court case in 1850-something, and Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896, as I recall, or 1898 Supreme Court case. And Obama talking, he made the comment that the Constitution is an imperfect document because it had this three-fifths of a person provision in it about slavery. This was all entirely in the context of slavery. And he talked about how the Supreme Court back in the 1870s, and for that matter, the legislation in the 14th Amendment, didn't address the economic issues of the day. And Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, and even Brown versus Board of Education. In fact, he said it's not appropriate for the Supreme Court to address economic issues. This is something that should go into the legislative area. And this, I guarantee you, has got the right wing hysterical. By the way, and just to, you know, Brad, I mean, he's talking about having cancer and he's not going to postpone the surgery because he's afraid of Obama. Well, if you got cancer, don't postpone the surgery. That's number one. Number two, Barack Obama has not, and nobody in his campaign has ever suggested that we should adopt the Canadian to the British system. I frankly would like the German or the French system, which is a single-payer system, which is, you know, Medicare, basically. Everybody has Medicare. The government does not own the hospitals. The government does not pay the doctors' salaries. It pays for services. It's just a giant insurance company. It's the cheapest insurance company around. And Obama's plan would allow people to buy into Medicare. And I think that that's going to vastly expand Medicare and put a lot of these guys out of business. So anyhow, that, let me get that point off the table because, you know, that talking point is sad and silly. But Barack Obama, in 2001...
The law school at the University of Chicago.
You know, if you look at... The victories and failures of the civil rights movement and its litigation strategy in the court. I think where it succeeded was to vest formal rights in previously dispossessed peoples so that I would now have the right to vote. I would now be able to sit at a lunch counter and order, and as long as I could pay for it, I'd be okay. But the Supreme Court never ventured into the issues of redistribution of wealth and sort of more basic issues of political and economic justice in the society. And to that extent, as radical as I think people tried to characterize the Warren Court, it wasn't that radical. It didn't break free from the essential constraints that were placed by the Founding Fathers in the Constitution, at least as it's been interpreted, and Warren Court interpreted it in the same way that generally the Constitution is a charter of negative liberties, says what the states can't do to you, says what the federal government can't do to you, but it doesn't say what the federal government or the state government must do on your behalf.
There you go. And that's true. This is a constitutional scholar talking about this. But the right is taking this and they're going hysterical. A little later on he talks about redistribution of wealth being a legislative prerogative. Yeah, it is. You know, some of my income gets to pay for those traffic lights that I like and the police protection that I enjoy. And you, too. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270. Get complete access to exclusive content from your favorite shows with Air America On Demand. Sign up now at airamerica.com. Now, back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com.
Do not beg for your salvation from preachers, kings, or masters. The people hold the power. Arise and claim your freedom. The wealthy enjoy services only at your acquiescence. Only while you stay in darkness. Arise, arise, arise. Because in the end, freedom will be international.
34 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Kent in Paris, France. Hey, Kent, thanks for listening to our web stream. What's up?
Hey, good to talk to you. I love your show. And I would just like to comment on your last guest. I'm sorry I don't remember the gentleman's name, but
Brad O'Leary.
There's always this impression of they throw out a straw man argument about health care where they pick Canada, they throw out Canada and the United Kingdom instead of picking better countries with better health care, like France, which the World Health Organization has said has the number one health care in the world in 2008. And instead of building a model upon that, they look at some other country or they pick a specific case and go after that and say, hey, look over here.
Do you use the French healthcare system?
Yes, I do.
What's been your experience?
It's absolutely excellent. And if one day when I do move back to the United States, I'm a U.S. citizen, my biggest point of hesitation in moving back is the healthcare system in the U.S. Mm. It's appalling in comparison to other countries. And I travel internationally for a living. I visit a lot of countries throughout this area. Mm. And it's just amazing to see the difference in what we accept as healthcare in the United States.
When I did my show from Denmark, I was interviewed by a guy who was an American who had been living in Denmark for over 20 years. He'd married a Danish woman. He was a reporter for one of the Danish newspapers. And he said that he had come down with cancer, been treated surgically, was cancer-free now. It had been 6 or 7 years. But he could not move back to the United States because he's uninsurable now because he has a previous condition, you know.
Yeah.
And so even if he wanted to move back to the United States, he couldn't move back. I mean, it's downright bizarre.
No, it's just whenever I think about, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I think healthcare definitely fits in with all those three. And life.
In particular.
Healthcare is life.
Yeah.
I mean, without that, and in the case you just mentioned, how can he actually live and have life if he's not going to be able to get health care and be insured for a life-threatening disease?
Yep.
I don't understand the argument. I think we really need to sit down and look at it. And
so the essentially single-payer system in France is working quite well for you. It costs you a couple $100 a month, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's a little more complicated. I mean, you can get little things added on with your insurer for, you know, glasses and different things. I won't go into the whole thing, but generally, I mean, you're just covered. There's nothing to worry about. And I broke my shoulder a year ago on vacation. And, you know, just in terms of how that was handled in a foreign country, how those bills get paid, how I was treated through the entire process, and how the physical therapy or reeducation of my arm has worked in the past year, I mean, there's no way in the United States it would happen like that.
It happened well, in other words.
Oh, just smooth, handled, sorted out, and minimum
costs,
of paperwork, minimum
right, and it
of
costs you, and it costs you nothing?
Basically, I think each initial doctor visit is refunded 100% except for €1.
Yeah, for €1. So it costs you, you know, a little about a buck and a half.
Yeah.
Kent, I got to move along. I got a whole board full of calls here, but thank you very much for listening
in
Paris, France, and thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. Sean in Alberta, Canada, you want to get weigh in on the Canadian perspective on this?
Hey, Tom, a huge fan of yours.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just always hear this argument coming from the ones who want to do the fear tactics on healthcare, like, oh, it's going to be like Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And just commenting on your last caller talking about America, the government bureaucracy being involved. Like, there is absolutely none. You walk into the doctor is the one who makes the decision. He can advise you what he thinks is the appropriate way, and he doesn't check in with anybody, and you get booked in instantly, smoothly, doesn't cost you a dime.
Yeah.
So where I come from, in my particular province, I'm probably in the more conservative part of the country, and we used to have to pay a premium here provincially, but we don't anymore, so we don't. It's all part of our income tax. It's all budgeted into there, what you pay on your income taxes per year, and I'm tired of it. It's not like the doctor has to walk into the back room and call the government to see if it's okay if he treats you for this or that. The only thing the government does is pay the bill.
Unlike in the United States, where if you need particularly something exotic like a transplant, they do have to call the health insurance company and say, will you pay for this?
Exactly. I love that. They say the government decides here, but
yeah.
But
yeah,
then it's actually like, in the States, it's the, you know, executives in an insurance company. I mean, my God.
Right. It's like everybody in America is watching House on TV, you know, this show about this renegade doctor who orders 5,000 tests and has four doctors on one cranky patient. And the reality is that before every single one of those decisions was made, they would have had to consult the health insurance company. I mean, that show is perhaps the way it works in France, but very definitely not the way it works in the United States.
Oh,
Sean.
Terrifies me.
Yeah.
We have the movement here. They're trying to bring in privatized health insurance into Canada. There's always that underlying law.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's big money to be made. There's big money to be made. And so you've got the conservative
market,
forces.
And that terrifies me.
There you go.
People who decide what you can do with your car would be deciding what you do with your health care.
Yeah. Yeah, not a good thing. Sean, that's a great meme. Thank you very much. Joe in Tempe, Arizona, you wanted to disagree with me, Joe.
Hey, yeah, have you ever been in a motor vehicle? That's what happens when the government runs something.
I beg your pardon?
When you go to motor vehicle, that's what happens when the government runs something.
Right. I went down to the DMV when I moved here to Oregon. It took me all of 12 minutes to get my new driver's license. They were very nice. Good people.
You know, if you open up health care to everybody, every hypochondriac in the world's going to go.
Yeah. You're worried about hypochondriacs, Joe?
Yeah. Oh, my finger hurts. Oh, I'm going to go to the doctor. Oh, that's what it's all about.
Why is it, Joe, that that doesn't happen in any other country in the world? Do you think Americans are just, like, mentally twisted or something?
Well, the latest poll says Obama's got 51%, so, yeah, I'd say 51%.
So you think that Americans are mentally ill?
51%, Mr. Liberal.
Yeah, 51% of Americans are mentally ill.
No.
That's really a sad commentary,
Hey, look
Joe.
At Obama. It's... Look at the Drudge Report today. Obama says he wants to redistribute wealth. That's what you guys are all about. You want to take my hard-earned money and put it in some guy's pocket.
Okay, so let me get this straight. William McGuire, the guy who was the head of United Healthcare, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, the last 10 years he worked there, this was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, which maybe you read, I don't know. If you do, you saw the story last year. When he left the company, his 10-year compensation was $1.78 billion.
Nice.
$1,780,000.
You ever get a job from a poor person? $700
million a year.
You ever get a job from a poor person?
As a matter of fact, yeah, I have. And as a poor person, I've given people jobs. I've started several companies with virtually nothing. I started one company on my American Express line of credit. I started another with an unemployment check. And yes, as a poor person, I've given people jobs. And yes, I've had, I've worked for people who are not rich. In fact, that's the case with most small businesses. It's very rare that rich people hire people.
Hey,
companies
Tom.
Hire people.
Tom.
But here's my point, Joe.
Okay,
this guy is making $350,000 a minute. What could he possibly do that's worth that?
Well, it's a capitalist system, and there's winners.
You say that that's
losers.
Earning money.
And what you liberals are upset about is that liberals usually end up losers.
Well, I think Americans are ending up losers, Joe. What you have is 40%, as John McCain points out, 40% of Americans make such lousy income that they can't even afford to pay for health insurance. They are so far below the poverty level that they don't even qualify to pay income taxes. Isn't that wrong? Shouldn't we say to William McGuire, sorry, there's no thing in the world that you can do that's worth $300,000 an hour or $300,000 a minute.
Hey, Tom.
And by the way, the people who work for you, they are entitled to make more than $6.25 an hour.
Hey, Tom, a Hollywood actor makes
answer the question, Joe.
Wait a minute. A Hollywood actor.
Joe, answer the question.
No, he's
working. Joe, what can he possibly do that's worth $300,000 an hour?
What's a baseball player do that he's worth the money they make?
I think a baseball player should be paying a 91% top marginal tax rate after $3.2 million,
oh,
too. Then we would go back to the baseball players making the same kind of pay that they were making in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and you would have the price of tickets going down at the stadium.
You really are a liberal, aren't you?
I really am, Joe. I really think that there is a point where when people are making obscene amounts of money by gaming the system, that we have an obligation as a society to step in and say, sorry, you're not gonna rip us all dry. You're not going to drain all the blood out of the system. You're not going to pile up all the rocks in front of your cave. We are a we society, not a me society, Joe.
You're
That's what I think.
You're a commie.
No, I'm not
You're
a communist.
A
I'm not suggesting that the government should run businesses, and I'm not suggesting that the government should run services. I don't want the government making my shoes or my clothes or my computers.
God
That's
God.
Communism.
God.
I am, however, I am proudly, Joe, a liberal. I proudly
God.
Believe that we should say to employers in the United States that if you want to run a business, then you have to, as a condition of all the freebies and benefits and tax breaks you get for running a business. And I can tell you, I've been there. I've run a lot of businesses in my years. That in exchange for that, you have to pay your employees a living wage.
Tom, one more thing. God bless Sarah Palin. God bless her soul. Have a good day.
Joe, you have no response to me? You got no rebuttal? Apparently not. Joe has hung up. Okay. Max in St. Louis. Yeah, God bless us all.
I want to call and talk about class warfare,
yep.
One of my favorite topics, because I believe it's practiced top down. But unfortunately, that gentleman, unless he can demonstrate that he's wealthy, that gentleman is one of the small people, like me, one of the little people. But they believe, they've bought into that people like you and me are the dangerous ones. We're going to bring socialism. We're going to bring class warfare. When, It is so frustrating to hear this stuff. God blesses Sarah Palin. Well, sir, if you want to be a lover of Sister Sarah, you go on and do so. But if you don't think that she's an elite, you're a fool.
She only made $250,000 last year.
Sister Sarah is an elite by virtue of the fact that she is governor of Alaska. He is not. You are not. I am not, sir.
Yeah. Well said, Max. Thanks a lot for the call. It is class warfare. And as Warren Buffett said, yes, there is class warfare. The second richest man in America, he said, and I quote, yes, there is class warfare in the United States. My class declared it, and we won. Actually, it's a quote from memory, maybe imperfect, but it's close. 46 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com. Fresh opinions and news you can use. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com. Now, back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com.
Let's dump the washed-up terrorists that stole our government. They've screwed up the environment and the economy. From sea to shining sea.
So what do you want for Christmas?
All I want for Christmas is a brand new president.
Brand new president. Preferably a Democrat. Preferably. Sometimes it's downright crazy out there. I'll tell you. Do not. Here's the lesson of the story. Do not try to rob a brothel with a machete. 22-year-old guy in Washington, D.C.'s Columbia Heights District tried to rob a brothel with a machete. One of the women grabbed it, chopped his thumb off. 2 hours later, a nine-fingered man shows up at the hospital. And after they reattached the thumb, which fit perfectly like a puzzle piece, according to the arrest affidavit, he found his butt in jail. So, yeah. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Scott the Plumber in Delray Beach, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you, Scott?
Oh, great. Listen, I was for your show.
Thank you.
And I was listening to the caller before the break, the one that was calling you a liberal.
Yeah. I'm proud to be a liberal.
I got to tell you, I'm a plumbing and air conditioning contractor down here, and I built my business. You know, no one gave me loans. No one gave me any grants. And pretty much built it on my back and my sweat and blood. And, you know, I would have no problem paying more money if I paid $250,000 a year. I would have no problem paying my tax.
Yeah. And you know, what's so amazing is these guys are hysterical because Barack Obama wants to raise taxes on people making over $250,000 back to the level they were during the Clinton administration, which was 36% instead of 33%. And so, you know, if somebody made $300,000, they'd pay like an extra $150 or $200 in taxes. And, you know, that's incredible. I don't think he goes anywhere near far enough. I think we should roll back the Reagan tax cuts. I'm totally in league with Republican President Dwight Eisenhower on this. Republican President Dwight Eisenhower believed, and he was outspoken about this, he said this on a number of occasions, that people earning over, in today's dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars, over $3.2 million should pay 91% income tax. And that's what it was throughout the 8 years of his presidency. That's what it was throughout Nixon's presidency. Nixon was an advocate of that. Of course, he was vice president under Eisenhower. That's what it was under LBJ's presidency. I'm wrong about Nixon. It had dropped down to 74%. JFK dropped it down to 74%, but he tightened up the loopholes, so people actually paid that 74%, and LBJ as well. But, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was all in favor of this, and I think he was right. It built a strong middle class, and it prevented huge dynasties, a small number of dynastic families. We've got a couple of thousand, we've got over 1,000 billionaires in the United States right now. That's an obscene amount of money, frankly, to be concentrated in the hands of one person. And it's not good for democracy, as Thomas Jefferson pointed out numerous times.
Yeah, I do remember a few quotes from him about that, but that's in Lincoln as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Lincoln, you know, labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital. Absolutely. In fact, Tom in Minneapolis sent me this Teddy Roosevelt quote. He says, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior capital and deserves much the higher recognition. If that remark was original with me, said Teddy Roosevelt, I should be even more strongly denounced as a communist agitator than I am now, than I shall be anyhow. It is Lincoln's. I am only quoting it. And that is one side. That is the side the capitalist should hear. Now let the working man hear his side. Capital has its rights, which are worthy of protection as our other rights, nor should this lead to a war upon the owners of property. Property is the fruit of labor. Property is desirable. It's a positive good in the world. So, Teddy Roosevelt, another Republican president that I agree with. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Very, very well said. Nikki in Lincoln, Nebraska. Nikki, you think that if we have free public health care that people are going to think that it's just great fun to go to the doctor and they're all going to show up?
You know what? I think it's abused. I have a lot of friends who have $10 copays and are constantly taking their kids to the doctor because it's easy. It's cheap, and why not? I, on the other hand, don't
because
have
Because most people
insurance.
Have better things to do with their lives, and most kids don't like to go to the doctor.
I appreciate what you're saying, but what I'm saying is what I see based on the people I associate with and the people I'm around. I do think that a lot of people take
Nikki,
advantage.
Seriously, I mean, seriously for a minute. How many friends do you have who take their kids to the doctors when they don't need to go to the doctor because the copay is only $10?
You know what? It's not that they don't need to go, but they have a cough. And so instead of, like, I ride the cough out, give it a few days, see what happens, those people take their kids immediately to the doctor because they can get them on antibiotics, see if they can get it taken care of quicker. I think people are too quick to try and use that system.
How much do you think the copay should be?
What a copay should be? You know, I think $25 is fair, something that is paying half of that fee or paying a good portion of the fee, where there's a little bit of resistance.
So what you're going to have then, Nikki, is somebody for whom $10 is a lot of money or $25 is a lot of money. They're not going to go to the doctor at all or until things are really serious. And for somebody for whom $25 is meaningless, they're still going to take their kids.
Hey, I'm not saying the health care isn't out of control, but no, if it's, I don't agree with that either. I mean, the problem is,
Nikki, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but the bottom line is we're always going to have abuse of the system, and we need to minimize it, and we need to have a good system.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carrie Lucas, who is the... I lost my page here. Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, is with us. Hey, Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's always nice having you on. I enjoy our conversations. You have recently wrote this piece called The Female Factor. You wrote this, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, The Female Factor over at the IWF.org website. And in it you say, and I'm quoting, I guess you're quoted in this piece, American women are wealthier, healthier, and better educated than at any time in our history, yet Professor McKinnon... You're referencing a Wall Street Journal piece that was essentially endorsing Barack Obama, casts women as under siege in America and victims of a system stacked against them. She sees a bigger and more activist government as the cure of women's ills. Unfortunately, big government policies tend to backfire on women, leading to a less flexible workforce, fewer job opportunities, slower economic growth, and less freedom for women and their families. End quote. Is that accurate, that quote?
Yeah, that's what I read. I was really shocked, I think, by Professor McKinnon's piece, because it did just paint such a a bleak picture of the situation that American women face. And I know there's, especially in the last few months, we've had some really tough economic times, and there is a lot of legitimate troubles out there. But especially for women, we shouldn't lose fact that we are the most blessed people on earth to live in America and be enjoy the freedoms that we all enjoy in the United States. And that, you know, women are doing really well in terms of education, in terms of succeeding in the workplace. We've got a lot to be happy about, and a lot of that is due to the free market economy, which gives women so much opportunity.
Now, Carrie, I'm a little older than you, but I would assert that this is the result of big government. I'm old enough to remember 1971 or 72, I forget which year it was. I was one of the brief gigs that I had where I actually had a job. In fact, this was the job, the unemployment check from which I used to start a business with. But I was the manager of a health food store that was part of a national chain, and the general manager, the guy who was the regional manager, had advised me, A, that he never hired women as managers because they didn't have authority, and B, when I was hiring, I remember looking in the newspaper, I had to place a help wanted ad, and I had to decide whether I wanted to put help wanted men or help wanted women. And his advice to me, and this is a guy who later became one of the senior vice presidents of this national company, his advice to me was hire women, they'll work for less. And that is now illegal as a result of big government. I mean, that is a real experience that I had in the 70s.
And
anybody who was hiring in the 70s saw that. I mean, watch the TV movie, the TV series Mad Men about the ad agency business in the 60s. I was in the ad agency business in the mid-70s. It wasn't that different. And so I would submit to you that what you are proclaiming, which is true, American women wealthier, healthier, and better educated than any time in our history, is the direct result of liberals in government.
Well, you know, I think that certainly there's been advances, and the government played a role in outlawing discrimination. But I also think, you know, a lot of this is, a chicken and the egg type of situation. You know, there were changing attitudes towards women. The women's movement had a lot to do with it. It wasn't just the legal regime that changed. A lot of people's attitudes towards women in the workforce changed. And certainly, you know, there's benefits with a lot of things that government does. But you also have to recognize the cost that those programs and even these regulations create.
What is the cost of requiring that if you're going to hire somebody for a job that you've budgeted $50,000 a year for, that if you hire a man, you can't pay him $52,000 versus hiring a woman and paying her $45,000?
No, you know, I think I'm all for it. Discrimination laws make a lot of sense, and that's a rational.
But that's big government.
Well, I mean, that's a government. You know, I'm not an anarchist. You know, I think that there's a proper role for government, and keeping them on a fair playing field makes sense. But what you have, that's one thing we can agree on. But then I hope we can also agree on that it should be businesses who decide how much their employees should be paid. What Professor McKinnon is talking about is having the government sit down and say, well, I think teachers are more valuable than sanitation workers. They clearly are better educated. So we need to stop paying, we need to have a comparable worth regime so that teachers make this much and sanitation workers make this much. People who are politically organized and can come and lobby the government are going to make this much, and then, you know, engineers and technical people who don't have lobbying groups and aren't as government savvy as a lot of other groups, they're going to make something
else.
Well,
hang on just a second. Aren't you mixing apples?
It frightens me, and that's what real liberals, a lot of these radical liberals, the feminists, that's what they want to do. That's literally.
Aren't you mixing apples and oranges here, Carrie? A teacher is a government employee, and so government,
not
of course, is going to decide.
I know how you dream of having a completely government-run public education system, but there are still private school teachers and there is some educational freedom out there.
Yeah, up until very recently, for the last 30 years, I've been on the board of directors of a private school. I know that.
Okay.
But by and large, most teachers in the United States are public employees, and that's a different thing from many of the other positions. I'm a little confused by this. You're suggesting that, because we do have right now in the United States the government telling employers how much they must pay. It's called the minimum wage law. Are you suggesting that there should be no minimum wage law?
Well, I actually actually, you know, I think that the minimum wage has created a whole lot of costs, and that's by pricing some people or people who are poorly educated and poorly skilled out of the marketplace. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of people who would have had their first jobs, teenagers who are no longer able to find employment because it doesn't make sense for...
So are you suggesting that if somebody, you know, let's set aside the teenagers. Back when I was a kid here, Carrie, we used to, I remember when I was 15, I got a job at Henry's Hamburgers, flipping burgers, and I had to get what was called a work permit back then, because in the state of Michigan, you couldn't work if you were under 16 years old without a work permit. And I had to go to the, as I recall, it was the Secretary of State's office, maybe it was a county office, and get this permit that my parents signed off on that they would allow me to work. But, you know, and there could be some sort of a provision, you know, for teenagers or just into the marketplace. But are you suggesting that if somebody has the misfortune of being born with an IQ of 95 and they're maybe able to struggle through high school and complete it, but they're never going to make it through college, and they're never going to have a high level of skills, but they have a lot of integrity, they're a decent person, and they're willing to work hard for 40 hours, that person should never be able to make enough money to actually put their family through, put their kids through school, own a home,
pay for health insurance? That's such an absurd premise of your question. That's like me asking
That's the premise of the minimum wage, Carrie.
Person, but you think this person should never be able to have that first job that will give them their start because you're going to make the minimum wage $15 an hour so that they'll never, no employer would ever hire them. There's two sides to that coin. We're talking about opportunity versus mandating how much somebody should be worth. But
the minimum wage in Denmark is $14.70 an hour, and they have an unemployment rate of around 2%.
High unemployment here in Europe. There's a lot of unemployment in Europe. So there's definitely a double-edged, there's some good things. Some people make more money, but then a lot of people are making no money at all.
But if you're unemployed, well, first of all, I may be wrong on this, but because it's been a few months since I was there, but I believe that the Danish unemployment rate is below ours. And secondly, if you're unemployed in Denmark, you get pretty good unemployment benefits that last for multiple years. I mean, there's basically a social safety net that people don't fall through. And the reality is that most people would rather be employed than unemployed. You know, just sitting around all day gets pretty boring pretty quickly.
Well, but there are also a lot of people who can't find jobs in many parts of Europe. But, you know, I think that this whole... us discussing whether or not anybody's going to repeal the minimum wages is a nice academic discussion, but that's not what alarmed me about that piece because, fine, minimum wage laws are one thing, but what Catherine McKinnon and a lot of radical feminists are talking about are literally wage setting, having a government agency that is overseeing how much different occupations are worth. And that's what she sees. She says that the marketplace, the free market, is de facto unfair to women because many professions that women gravitate towards are paid less. She thinks that the government's going to know better. I think that's pretty frightening, and I would hope that even a good liberal would recognize some of the problems that are created by putting so much power in the hands of government.
To the extent that I don't think that the government should be establishing wages, broadly speaking, I don't disagree with you, Carrie, on that. I read Catherine McKinnon's column slightly differently. If that was what she was saying, if you wanted to characterize that, I wouldn't disagree with you. I simply think that we need to have a high enough minimum wage that somebody, you know, with an IQ of 95 can not only become president of the United States as we have right now, but can also get a decent minimum wage job and actually raise a family.
All right.
Okay. We'll wrap it up there. Carrie Lucas, the VP for Policy and Economics, the Independent Women's Forum. I didn't hear a protest. IWF.org. Carrie, thanks so much for dropping by.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Always a pleasure. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com.
I do my best to play by the rules. I bend a couple, even break a few. Don't get me wrong. Half a dozen of these.
minute past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Georgia's Secretary... I'm reading from a story on CNN. Georgia's Secretary of State, Karen Handel, a Republican who began working on purging voter rolls since she was elected in 2006. What is wrong with this picture? A lawsuit has been filed over Georgia's mismatch system. The state is also under fire for requesting Social Security records for verifications on about 2 million voters. 2 million. In Florida, election officials found that 75% of about 20,000 voter registration applications from a three-week period in September were mismatched due to typographical and administrative errors. Right, somebody types one letter wrong. Well, it's like Joe the plumber. He's got one letter spelled wrong in his last name. Are they going to let him vote in Ohio? Yeah, probably, because he's actually Joe the plumber. But Florida's Republican Secretary of State ordered the computer match system implemented in early September. This is the Paul Weyrich program. Paul Weyrich, the Republican consultant who ran the Reagan campaign and has been active in Republican politics ever since, speaking to a group of Republican Christian activists in a church about 15 years ago.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And Wendy Weiser, elections expert with New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, says what most people don't know is that every year election officials strike millions of names from the voter rolls using processes that are secret, prone to error, and vulnerable to manipulation. That means that lots and lots of eligible voters could get knocked off the voter rolls without any notice, and in many cases without any opportunity to correct it before election day. I'm telling you, the Republicans, they knocked 3 million people. In the 2004 election, showed up to vote. 3 million United States citizens who believed that they were registered to vote and eligible to vote showed up to vote and were told, sorry, you cannot vote. Millions more were given provisional ballots, in many cases which were never even opened, as in the state of Ohio. Over 100,000 of them from the 2004 election, provisional ballots that never even got around to being opened. And the Republicans are fixing to do it again. They are going to try to steal another election. I'm telling you, it is coming. It is coming. But that's nothing compared to this. Colorado couple found an unusual topping on their order of tacos. Yeah, they pulled into the Del Taco restaurant in Lakewood. And 26-year-old Dennis Clermont, who was working there, passed them out their tacos and a bag of pot. Oh, my. Well, things sometimes, I guess, you know, some days just don't work out all that well. They immediately call the police. Philip in Boca Raton, Florida, listening on Wednesday. Philip, what's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, just a couple of quick points. First of all, it really slays me when they call it socialism. We just went out and the government bought non-voting preferred shares in the bank. That means the same clowns that caused the mess can cause it again. There's no stopping.
Right, and according to the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday of last week, I read the story on the air. 10%, up to 10% of the $700 billion, $70 billion, is going to be used for employee compensation.
Yeah, that's on their bonus pool. That has to be part of their books.
Right.
Part of the statements, it must be on their bonus pool. So, I mean, it just slays me that they talk. That's just a giveaway. That's crony capitalism.
Yeah.
Now, let me get to the main point, and then I'll make two additional comments, if I may. I think part of the problem is a measuring problem. That is, when a country is evaluated in terms of wealth, we look at the gross domestic product, or the gross national product. That says a dollar for goods is the same as a dollar for services. In other words, if I manufacture something in a steel plant, that's equivalent to selling burgers in a burger stand. But that can't be, because the lead and the lags are different. If I shot a burger stand, I can open a burger stand up tomorrow. If I shot a plant down, I can't open a plant tomorrow. Not only that, the number of feeder industries that feed off a burger plant is minuscule in relation to the number of feeder industries that feed off a steel plant. What makes a country great is how it competes on the world market.
Yeah.
And certainly,
well, beyond that, the extent to which we are shipping jobs overseas, they're largely manufacturing jobs. Those, you know, that money is not only not staying in the United States, But all of the secondary things, I mean, all the, when somebody has a job, they buy things, you know, and so that, and then they buy things from local businesses. Those local businesses then employ people, and those people buy things, and that's how an economy grows.
Our economy
has been steadily contracting ever since Ronald Reagan came into office.
That is correct. It's one thing I don't understand, that $700 billion we gave to the banks. I could take that, open up seven pristine banks, just the perfect balance sheet,
yeah.
Give them $100 billion in each of those banks.
Yeah.
Guess what? They can lend the money. These banks
You're right.
Anything.
Well, and these banks, I mean, again, the Financial Times, oddly, thank you, Philip, the Financial Times, which, by the way, today endorsed Barack Obama for President of the United States. The Financial Times has more readers in the United States than they do in the U.K., even though it's the U.K.'s kind of Wall Street Journal. The Financial Times, I just find that incredible. I just find it absolutely incredible. They have endorsed Barack Obama. And you know, pointing out also that this bailout is, in England, they're actually buying the banks and saying, we're going to take control. Here, we're simply giving them money and saying, do whatever you want.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
Radio program protecting America from the weapons of mass deception. Oh, strange stuff going on. North Carolina, more than in the 2004 election, more than 90,000 people voted, went to all the trouble of going to the polls, but didn't vote for president. 90,000 people. Now, this is a state where George Herbert Walker Bush was going up against Bill Clinton, he beat him by 43.34% versus 42.65%. That's less than 1%. And in 2004, 90,000 people voted but didn't vote for president, and it looks like it might happen again. Over 100,000 people, their votes for president will not be counted. Why? Because in North Carolina, if you vote straight party ticket, if you go in and say, yes, I am filling in the circle or pushing the button for nothing but the Democratic Party, it doesn't record a vote for president. Now, they're calling this a poorly designed ballot. I'm quoting one of these people who thought, you know, Linda Chavez, she says, I was sure I voted for president, but then a friend told me that a straight party vote in North Carolina includes every office except president. That made me really mad. I thought I voted against George Bush, but it turned out I didn't vote for president at all. It's an issue today that we're still seeing in the same confusing ballot. I'm telling you, it's all about voter suppression. The only strategy that the Republicans have is to keep people from voting or keep people from voting correctly. And it's worked for them for 8 years. We've had two stolen elections now. And so now they're beating the drum of stolen election. It's all acorn, blah, de, blah, de, blah. Because why? Because they're stealing elections. And they're stealing elections to the tunes of millions of votes and millions of voters. And they're setting this up. You know, to this day, there are Republicans who believe that John Kennedy was not a legitimate president because the vote got stolen in Chicago. That's by Mayor Daley. That story has now been thoroughly debunked. There were some ballot stuff down in Texas by buddies of Lyndon Johnson's, but it didn't happen in Chicago. But there are still people who believe it because the Republicans put that story out so that Jack Kennedy, when he became president, would not have a mandate, that the American people would think that there was something wrong with his presidency. They see this coming. They see an Obama presidency coming. And they're right now already Fox News full time trying to make people believe that this is not going to be a legitimate presidency. And what a tragedy. What a tragedy. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Well, with all these voting problems, I want to mention to listeners there are two big ways we can help. One is we need to keep track of this stuff. Thus, a few years ago, I created a website called reportvotingproblems.org.
Okay.
And I've got a database there that you can report any kind of problems, such as voting machine problems, whether you get got purged from the rolls or whatever.
Report voting problems.org?
Report voting problems.org.
Okay.
It's a database of, so we're trying to quantify all this so it's not just anecdotal. We really need to keep the data on this rather than just, you know, here and there have different rumors. We need to quantify this.
Right.
The other one is, you've talked about exit polling for a long time. Mm. Well, Election Defense Alliance and some others are working to do citizen exit polling. And I am the head of the polling in Colorado. We're looking for volunteers, for people of all political persuasions to come out with us on Election Day and do exit polling. We're trying to do it as open as possible. The data will be available to everybody.
That's great.
So if you're in Colorado, you can go to honestelections.us and register there.
Okay.
If you're outside of Colorado, go to electiondefensealliance.org, and the link is on the left-hand side for volunteering there. But okay. We need
honestelections.us, electiondefensealliance.org.
Yes.
Got it. Jeff, thank you very much. And
thank
I
you.
Will, you're welcome. I will repeat those a little later on as well. Linda in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Linda.
Yes. Hi, Tom. A couple of things. Ohio and Cuyahoga County and Cleveland are under siege, and the GOP has mounted a hostile takeover, as far as I'm concerned, and it's aided and abetted by the Bush Injustice Department. They've had raids on county commissioners, judges, Metro Housing Authority, and contractors. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of State, Jennifer Bruner, is under assault by frivolous last-minute lawsuits and unreasonable demands by the GOP.
Yep.
It's just to confuse and confound the Election Day process. And I think that all of this, including that 90,000 thing in North Carolina or South Carolina, wherever it was, should be litigated on the basis of equal protection of the laws.
Yes.
I mean, we've really got to stand
it. Yeah, arguably, these are all violations of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
But the problem is that right now you have a Justice Department that will not enforce these. In fact, you have a Justice Department that fired 9 prosecutors
right.
for refusing to prosecute ACORN because they could find no crime.
Right. Well, I think that that's why this assault on Cuyahoga County is happening, because the justice lawyer is doing the bidding of the politicized Justice Department.
Yep.
I also want to say one thing about the lies about Obama's taxes. No business pays taxes on gross income. It's always after deductions, and it's net taxable income. And that's the way it needs to be talked about.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely. And let's keep in mind, by the way, one of the things that are deductions from gross income to create that net taxable income are payroll. So, you know, it's... Anyhow, Shelley in Ada, Oklahoma. Hey, Shelley.
Hey, Tom. I was watching Sarah Palin this morning as much as I could stand of it, and she was again... saying that Joe the plumber, you know, said it sounded like socialism to him when Barack Obama said spread the wealth.
Right.
And I've been doing some reading on the Alaska Permanent Fund, and you can find this information at www.apfc.org.
Right.
And it's interesting that Sarah Palin actually increased this payout to every Alaskan citizen. As long as you've been in Alaska for a year, you're entitled to apply for this money. And it's not from the fund invests 25% of all the oil royalties that the state receives.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't taxes or coming from anything from the oil companies. It's dividends from the income on the investments that the state makes with the money that they get from the oil companies.
Right, I'm looking at this at apfc.org.
Right.
And the fund value right now is $28
billion. Billion, yeah.
And it's invested in U.S. stocks, bonds, global stocks, real estate, private equity, non-U.S.
Right.
bonds, infrastructure. And so basically what she is running is the most socialist government, given state governments,
in
the
United States. If that's not sharing the wealth, what is? Those people didn't pay into that. That's not... I mean, they just get that money for being a resident there. It's
right.
nothing that they've done. And $2,069 per person plus the additional $1,200 that Sarah Palin said. That I mean, the extra $1,200 that she initiated in July of this year, that comes straight out of the oil revenues, the royalties and taxes that's in the state's general fund.
Right. So she increased taxes on the oil companies, which probably in her world would mean that, they cut jobs, although frankly, you know, in the real world it doesn't. She increased taxes on the oil companies, and she redistributed that income to every citizen of Alaska. And she is not a socialist, but Barack Obama is. What is wrong with this picture? Well said, Shelley. Thank you very much. It is very, very strange out there. It's getting so strange. Paul in Brooksville, Florida. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I can't tell you how many water cooler wars I've won with your aid.
Thank you.
Several. I just wanted to bring up something that, you know, was almost kind of a dead subject, but I really don't think it should be allowed to die. The girl that mutilated herself, carved the bee in her face.
Right.
Was that not, by definition, an act of terror itself?
Well, I think it was more an act of mental illness, frankly, Paul.
But wouldn't you argue that her goal was to, you know, instill fear in a certain group of voters?
My guess is that her goal was to get attention for herself. I would argue that Drudge was the terrorist in this, if you want to use that phrase. That he and the McCain campaign, John and Sarah calling this girl's house and then publicizing it. The fact that in Pennsylvania, the head of the PR for the McCain campaign in Pennsylvania was publicizing this, was feeding this to reporters.
And they added that little, you know, they were the ones that added that little bit about him coming back and, you know, seeing the bumper sticker and then coming back and saying, you know, I'm going to teach you a lesson. And
right. Yeah. And that story was promoted by the McCain campaign. And that is designed to strike fear in people's hearts. So you could argue that that is an act of terrorism. I think as far as this 20-year-old girl goes, though, or young woman, it's a tragedy.
Well, somehow I feel from the side that she's on, somehow there's going to end up being all kinds of praise heaped upon her. You know, look how much she cares about her cause.
I don't think so. I think that even people on the right get it. You know, Michelle Malkin actually was one of the first people to come out and say this thing stinks.
Right.
You know, no mugger is going to take the time to carefully carve that bee and to do it in as if it was done in a mirror. Obvious, I think, to pretty much to everybody except Matt Drudge and except the Fox News and except the McCain and Palin campaigns. And they were the ones who were flogging this story and promoting it and trying to make it a real high-profile thing. And as a result of that, there's a bunch of low-information voters out there who still believe that it's true. Because, you know, as is always the case, the big story was a big story. The retraction lasted for what, an hour? 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. In a stunning admission, Sequoia Voting Systems has admitted to not printing and mailing over 11,000 absentee ballots to Denver, Colorado voters. Their spokeswoman claimed they made an unfortunate mistake. In fact, the company had failed to notify the city of this mistake, and when originally asked, they lied and told the city they had delivered all 21,450 ballots they were supposed to print and deliver to the post office on October 16. Sequoia claims they will have ballots printed and delivered to the post office by Monday, by today. Voters have until Election Day to get those ballots marked and either back in the mail or delivered to an early voting site. Bizarre. Ellen Ratner with the talk. I'm telling you, when we privatized our vote, democracy started committing mass suicide. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, how you doing today?
I'm okay. And then what happens if the person that was supposed to get the absentee ballot happens to be on vacation that week?
Right, or out of town, or you know, whatever. Yeah. Then they don't vote. This is just crazy. And in North Carolina, 90,000 people didn't vote for president in the 2004 election. Why? Because they voted a straight ticket. And if you vote a straight ticket in North Carolina, your presidential election isn't taken. So they're guessing at least 100,000 people this year in North Carolina will not record a vote for president, although they will vote for every other Democrat on the ticket. I mean, the Republicans are doing everything they can in every state in this country to try to suppress the vote. And meanwhile, their news vehicle, you know, I was on Fox News this morning, and the segment before I came on, they did a whole segment about Acorn now in 13 states or 15 states. We found that they've submitted registrations. They actually say that Acorn is registering people, which is not true. Acorn doesn't register people. Secretary of State's offices register people. Acorn submits the registrations. They are setting it up to say when Obama is elected president that it's not a legitimate election and he's not a legitimate president.
Well, they can say anything they want. I think they're going to be very surprised on election day.
Well,
I'm pretty hopeful.
I hope you're right. I sure hope you're right. We cannot get complacent.
And no, we can't. But I have to just tell you a funny thing that happened today. Jean Shaheen is running, as you know, for senator in the state of New Hampshire, and she's running against John Sununu. Well, she came up with an ad that said that Sununu is connected to the president. He then countered with an ad. I don't know what was 9/11 or what was the situation, but where she said she supports the president. And it was some esoteric event or thing, right? Mm-hmm. So now the ad is running on in New Hampshire where she's saying, I support the president, I support the president. I mean, these guys will think of anything they can, take anything.
So the Republicans are attacking the former Democratic governor and senatorial candidate for saying, presumably after 9/11, that she supports the president.
I don't know if it was 9/11, it was some other event, but it was something. Something that, you know, most people would probably support the president on a couple issues.
Right.
But whatever it was, he took it completely out of context and now is making her look like the person painted with Bush.
Amazing. Hey, Ellen, you know, you're also a correspondent for Fox News. Here's a story to pass along to them.
I'm an analyst for Fox News.
Here's a story to pass along. Up until this election, every time there have been all these stories about electronic voting machines flipping votes, you know, people pushing the button for the Democrat and it says, thank you for voting for the Republican.
Right.
They've always flipped D to R. Now in Decatur County, Tennessee, they are reporting that votes are flipping. People are trying to vote for John McCain, and it's flipping to Barack Obama. That should get them hysterical. And if Fox News can get hysterical about voting machines, maybe something can be done about the voting machines.
I'll pass it along when I'm on.
okay.
The other thing that is interesting is the Treasury said they are now ready to send funds to banks. They're going to begin giving about $125 billion with a B dollars to 9 major banks.
With no strings attached.
I'm sorry?
With no strings attached, no oversight.
Well, supposedly there's going to be something about purchase of stock, but yes, they're saying that they're not going to run the banks.
Right, it's non-voting stock, so they have no say.
And then they're also going to make another $125 million of purchases by the end of the year, mainly focusing on regional banks.
Right, billion dollars, yes.
Billion with a B.
Yeah, it's... This is what we are seeing is trickle-down economics in the financial sector. You know, it's, you know, save the people on the top. And in fact, there was a story in the New York Times, I think it was Friday or Saturday, that said that many of these banks now are sitting on this money and using it. In fact, one of them actually on the record said that they were encouraged to use it. This was in a conference call that a reporter was not supposed to be on. We're being encouraged to use the money for acquisitions. In other words, to buy out smaller banks. So what we're seeing is the further consolidation
not
of banking.
Not making liquidity.
Right, right. Rather than making loans, they're using it to buy other banks. And so we're seeing Reaganism on steroids here. Ronald Reagan, the mergers and acquisition mania, the consequence of his suspending the Sherman antitrust law and thinking bigger is better. And we're going to make more and more of these tottering towers that are too big to fail, but when they do fail, could take down the entire country with them. This is so wrong.
As some of them have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Only piece of good news is that apparently new residential home sales did rise last month, 2.7%, seasonally adjusted. They had there was an expectation that it would be a little lower. Inventory of unsold homes dropped a little bit. Unclear why this is happening, but
it's because of auctions. Because the average price of those homes was down 9%. So these are homes that are being auctioned off. Banks have taken possession of homes and they're auctioning them. These are foreclosures.
You have it.
Yeah. So, yeah. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Your source for all the news of the day. Ellen, thanks so much for dropping by. I guess Ellen is gone. Anyhow, always great talking to her. Stick around. The Tom Hartman program here. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Antonia Juhas is with me. She's the author of a new book. It is called The Tyranny of Oil. And the subtitle, Antonia, I went to, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. First of all, welcome to our studio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And welcome to Portland, Oregon, where tonight at 7:30 you're going to be at Powell's down at Burnside, the main Powell's store, doing a book signing. And so our listeners here to KPOJ should drop by and say hi.
That'd be great.
The World's Most Powerful Industry and How to Stop It. Mm-hmm. Why, when you drove here in a vehicle that was powered by oil, should we stop the oil industry? Or what do you mean by that?
Well, this is why I was so a little disoriented when I got here. I never drive. The good news, I don't own a car. In San Francisco, I live in one of the few cities in the nation where that's absolutely doable.
It's
we
a
have
very
a
walkable city.
Walkable, but we have invested in public transit. We've made it really possible for people to not use cars. Of course, for most people in most parts of the country, those investments simply haven't been made. And instead, we have, in one of the ways that I use the word tyranny, a sort of tyrannical necessity of being stuck using oil. And what I argue in the book is, of course, that this is not a coincidence. This is by design. And the subtitle, The World's Most Powerful Industry, I'm essentially equating profit with power. And I've looked at the largest oil corporations operating within the United States, ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP Shell, ConocoPhillips, and then Marathon and Valero, look at their profit and found that essentially around the year 2000, which is a key turning point, these companies became hand-down, period, absolutely no comparison whatsoever with any other industry, the most profitable industry ever in the history of the United States, mm-hmm. and that has coincided with a tremendous strengthening of their political dominance over the decision-making of our government, of course, affecting the economy,
in
climate
ways?
Change, war.
Affecting climate change, keeping us out of the Kyoto Treaty, those kind of things.
Well, everything. So from deciding after 27 years that we need to eliminate the ban on offshore oil drilling, it was an intense and concerted propaganda effort by the oil industry. And cash. Remember, McCain got his first huge influx of oil industry money came after he reversed his previous opposition to offshore oil drilling.
Oh, that's interesting. And he has Sarah Palin, the oil lady from Texas.
The second big bump up in oil industry campaign giving to that ticket came with Palin. And they have now become the most oil-infused presidency ticket in the history of the United States.
So really, the McCain-Palin ticket is the oil industry ticket.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, hands down.
So You said 2000 was a turning point. Why and how?
A couple things happened in 2000. That's when George Bush was appointed president for the first time, and that was, at that point, the hallmark of oil industry giving to any presidency was to
because
get Bush.
Because he was
Cheney
an oil
in.
Man, Cheney was an oil man.
And they were Condoleezza Rice, an oil woman, more experience actually as on the head of Chevron's board of directors than she had working for government when she came into office. And not just them. What they brought with them was, at a minimum, 30 key bureaucrats who filled all the key echelons of the administration that basically came straight out of the oil industry so the oil industry could stop lobbying and start legislating, and that's what they did. But in 2000, actually right before Bush came into office, was a key legislative victory by the oil industry teaming up with the banks and Enron that got nice team up, right? No one you want to meet in a dark alley.
Right.
That got Phil Graham, former Texas Senator Phil Graham, to slip a little piece of legislation into the 1,100-page omnibus appropriations bill that passed that year called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Now, anyone curious about what's happened with subprime mortgage crisis and the banking crisis, this is a great piece of legislation to know.
And why oil and gold and wheat and copper and everything else, why all of a sudden all these commodities became so volatile in their prices.
Completely deregulated. So the oil industry joined with the banking industry to set up their very own exchange on which to trade crude oil, a completely deregulated exchange. They set it up in 2000, but 2006 is the moment when the amount of trades on that deregulated exchange surpassed the amount of trades on the regulated New York Mercantile Exchange, and that's when the price catapulted into the stratosphere.
Wow. So it really was market manipulation.
It was and continues
to
be market manipulation.
We're talking with Antonia Juhas. She is the author of a new book, The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. Antonia, let me play a clip here from Jimmy Carter. This is from July 15, 1979. I'd like to get your take.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Now, number one, and then here's number two.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
20%. We're at 0.2%. And he actually got the legislation in got the legislation passed.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan came into office and rolled all his stuff back.
Literally took the solar panels off the White House.
Off the roof of the White House. You're absolutely right. How would the world be different if Jimmy Carter's presidency had continued, if the Iranians had not held those hostages those last 2 weeks? Because 2 weeks out, mm-hmm. he was 7 points ahead, as I recall, of Ronald Reagan. It was just in the last 2 weeks that it really collapsed. And, the failed rescue attempt. And there are some who suggest that George Herbert Walker Bush had been involved with his the guy who became the head of the CIA, his campaign manager, to keep those hostages there. And that the payoff was called the Iran-Contra affair.
Mm-hmm.
How would the world be different if Carter had been successful in that? And to what extent do you think that the oil industry helped take down Jimmy Carter and define our domestic and foreign policies over the last 25, 30 years?
Well, I go over a lot of this history in the book, and this is obviously critical history. There was a period of time actually begun between the 1973 oil crisis, and which essentially ended with the presidency of Ronald Reagan, where we succeeded in one key approach that we had decided we would use to essentially defeat OPEC, and that was to reduce consumption of oil.
This is something that started under Nixon?
Yeah, and it succeeded for a time. We reduced energy consumption by about between 20 and 30%.
This is lower speed limits, tax deductions for insulating your homes,
energy efficient, more energy efficient cars. Cafe standards.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
And a reaction to price. Right, the price of oil had gone through the roof, and people were using less gasoline.
Right.
But we had also just put in a whole mandate. Jimmy Carter, however, also, you know, had a very intimate relationship with the Shah of Iran and was very eager in maintaining the power of the Shah,
right.
and had played a very strong role in making sure that U.S. oil companies were able to maintain their power position within Iran, and he did that through arms sales
to
the Shah.
He made a deal with the devil, and the devil
bit him back.
That's right.
Absolutely bit him back. I mean, yeah. In Iran, Jimmy Carter is definitely not seen as any sort of American hero. Mm. And so, you know, there's no, I guess my answer to this question, there's no clean presidency when it comes to oil.
Yeah.
And certainly the oil industry, however, significantly funded the Reagan administration, wanted to get the Reagan administration in, knew that they would get a better shake out of the Reagan administration, particularly in terms of deregulation within the United States,
right.
And most fundamentally, a complete reorientation under the Reagan administration, and I go into this extensively in the book, on antitrust policy. So essentially, antitrust policy in the United States was born to take down Standard Oil. It was eliminated under Reagan, and what followed was, it took about 100 years, but Reagan really was the one who changed U.S. policy to allow those former broken up pieces of Standard Oil, 1911, hallmark of the...
Trust-busting
president, yeah. But the populist movement, the hallmark of the success of the populist movement in the United States was breaking up Standard Oil into 34 separate parts. An antitrust policy, actually, people say if the Standard Oil Trust was called the Standard Oil Corporation, we would have anti-corporation laws in the United States.
Rather than antitrust laws.
That's right.
Amazing. Antonia Juhasz is the author of the book, The Tyranny of Oil. This is the world's most powerful industry and what we must do to stop it. She'll be tonight at Powell's for those of you here in Portland and everywhere else. Check out the book. 16 minutes past the hour. Thanks so much, Antonia, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman,
Rachel Maddow,
Lionel,
and more.
Download all of your favorite shows with Air America On Demand. Sign up now at airamerica.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on airamerica.com.
Minutes past the hour, speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you weren't all that familiar with. Tom Hartman here with you. Kim Bobo on the line with us. Kim is the executive director for the Interfaith Worker Justice Organization, IWJ.org is the website, author of Lives Matter, a handbook for Christian organizing, and co-author of the best-selling organizing manual in the country, Organizing for Social Change, IWJ.org, the website. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You recently testified before Congress about wage theft. Tell me about this.
Well, wage theft is when employers steal wages from workers. So it's when they don't pay them minimum wage, they don't pay them overtime they're supposed to, they misclassify them, or they just flat out don't pay them at all. And it's really a national crisis right now that employers feel free to just steal wages, knowing that there's probably not going to be any consequences for it.
I think most people, when they hear this kind of a story, Kim, think, yeah, that probably happens with, for example, illegal migrant or undocumented migrant workers, you know, people mm-hmm. who are in the country and who are afraid that their employer might turn them in or whatever. They're afraid to protest. Are you suggesting that this is widespread beyond that population?
It really is, Tom. It's not just undocumented immigrants, right? I mean, now, undocumented immigrants might have some of the worst abuses, right? But it's nursing home workers, it's dietitians, it's restaurant workers, it's service workers, it's, you know, there's just literally millions of workers who are not getting paid. And
is
in
this
fact,
a bet
probably, that, go ahead. Uh-huh.
Is this a bet that industry is making that basically the people at the bottom of the economic food chain, as it were, won't have the resources to hire a lawyer or won't have the time, frankly, desperately trying to get another job just to keep from being homeless, won't have the time to contact local authorities who might be able to prosecute?
I think that's part of it, and it's also that they know if, in fact, if they do file a complaint, that probably nothing will happen. So I think there's a number of companies that really don't take our labor laws seriously and feel like workers are so vulnerable in terms of afraid of losing their jobs, afraid they can't find other jobs, that they'll just accept treatment even though it's illegal. But it happens. This wage theft is... it's really a problem that's very widespread in the nation, and it's billions of dollars that are stolen, not millions, billions of dollars that are stolen from workers. And you know, it's not only bad for workers and their families, which is pretty obvious, but it's also bad for ethical employers, right, because unethical employers undercut you and can underbid you because they're stealing wages from workers. And it's bad for public coffers because it means that we're not paying all the payroll taxes that ought to be done and workers' comp and so forth. And finally, it's really bad for our communities because, you know, right now in this time of economic downturn, when we're looking at various ways to have economic stimulus, what better stimulus would there be than to have workers actually paid all their wages?
Right. The source of all demand in the economy, or virtually all demand in an economy, is wages.
That's right.
And so if you're going to steal wages, you're stealing demand out of the economy, and that ultimately that hurts the economy. We're talking with Kim Bobo, the Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice, IWJ.org. Your website describes Interfaith Worker Justice. It says it's a network of people of faith that calls upon our religious values in order to educate, organize, and mobilize the religious community of the United States on issues and campaigns that will improve wages, benefits, and conditions for workers and give voice to workers, especially low-wage workers. Most of the, Kim Bobo, most of the work that I've seen over the years that associates communities of faith with worker rights movements has been within the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to us about the extent to which this is still, you know, one of the main areas of focus of Catholicism, or of certainly movements within the Catholic Church, and how it's gone beyond the Catholic Church, and mm-hmm. who you're organizing in this regard.
Absolutely. Well, the Catholic Church, as you probably know, has just an incredibly strong history and teachings on the rights of workers to organize. And
yes,
in fact, Catholic social teaching says that not only is it okay to be organized and to be into unions, but it's a good thing for people to organize, right, to improve conditions in the workplace. So there's just incredible history and tradition there in the Catholic Church. And that's being just getting more involved right now because of all the immigrant communities around.
Mm-hmm. Many of whom are Catholic.
Exactly right. And so we're just seeing lots of...
But are we seeing this spread into the Protestant churches as well?
But yes, we're seeing that this concern about how workers are treated is very strong in the Protestant communities. You know, I was just out at an ecumenical summit on Saturday in Iowa that was primarily called by Methodists and Presbyterians.
Now, this has long also been a tenet of Judaism, as the support of
workers
as well.
Yes, I mean, it's Judaism. It's also the Islamic community is very involved in these issues as well.
This is great.
This is actually an issue that unites us across various traditions. And, you know, in addition to those, we're also seeing evangelical congregations get involved in this, again, because there are so many workers in their congregations that are really hurt by what's going on.
Kim Bobo, the website Interfaith Worker Justice, IWJ.org. Check it out. Kim, thanks so much for dropping by.
All righty. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270. Fresh opinions and news you can use. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
The older you get, another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter's.
stove.
Okay, here's the guy who has been hauling those 16 tons his whole entire life. A national hero, a national treasure, the guy I voted for president in 2000. He's running again, Nader Gonzalez, 08. I will be voting for Obama, sadly, Ralph, but welcome to the show. VoteNader.org, by the way, the website. Ralph Nader.
Tom, why would you want to waste your vote piling on a landslide for Obama? I mean, he's going to landslide McCain. You can just tell in every state where McCain and Obama are not campaigning or putting ads in, like California and Oregon and Washington State, New York, Massachusetts, Texas, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a good argument, Ralph, and it's the argument that I used in 2000 to, you know, vote for you is I wanted the Green Party to get that federal matching funds, and I believed in your candidacy. I, you know, although if I'd lived in Florida, I would have voted for Al Gore. I lived in Vermont, and I knew it wouldn't make any difference. And you make a good point. Although all across the United States, I don't think we can take this for granted anywhere, because all across the United States, perhaps not in Oregon, but everywhere else in the United States, they are ripping people off the voting rolls. I mean, we're seeing voter disenfranchisement like it's going on light warp. But I'm curious about your thoughts about this bailout. We're hearing today that they just shoveled $125 billion of our tax dollars, not even our tax dollars, money borrowed in our name, to the banks, and they're buying preferred shares, no voting rights, no oversight, no nothing.
No membership on the board of directors.
Right, exactly. And at the same time, and these are issues that you've been very involved with over the years, you know, corporate governance. And at the same time, they're screaming at Joe Biden. I was on Fox News this morning. They're all hysterical because they think that Joe Biden's a socialist. I mean, what's wrong with this picture, Ralph Nader?
Epidemic of hypocrisy. Socialism in Washington, bailing out capitalism, corporate capitalism in Wall Street, no criteria, no accountability. They're stampeding the people of this country the way they did on invading Iraq, Bush, and with the complicity of the Democrats, of course, who dominate Congress. And what they really should have done, if they wanted to bail out Wall Street, they should have. Washington had Wall Street over a barrel 3.5 weeks ago. Wall Street is desperate, wanted $700 billion. What they could have done is made the speculators pay for their own bailout. And nobody knows that better than Tom Hartman, because he wrote an article recently on the history of taxes on stock transactions and speculation going back to the Civil War.
Right.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And,
right.
And what I've been saying all over the country, you will not hear your favorite son Obama say this, is that a 0.1% tax on derivative trading, which now will total $500 trillion this year and keeps going up, will produce $500 billion that will make the speculators pay for their own bailout. And then there should have been a criminal prosecution provision with adequate resources to go after the corporate crooks. You can't believe how many people around the country are raising that with me. And then also, to make sure that there's federal comprehensive regulation. Well, the Democrats blew it, saying, oh, no, we got to give Bush what he wanted, a little window dressing, so let's do it next year. Next year, they have no leverage at all.
Right.
This is when they had the leverage. And I think the tax proposal that Nader Gonzalez have is a 90% support in the polls. Listen to this. Mm-hmm. We should tax first what society likes the least or dislikes the most. And that means before we tax human labor, before we tax workers. And that means we tax speculation. We tax more the addictive industries, corporate crime, pollution through a carbon tax. We tax the gambling industry more before we start taxing honest labor. And I've even reduced it to a poem. Tax what we burn, not what we earn. Tax what we bet, not what we net.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. I like that. Right.
You think you can get Obama to talk about this or crack
it
down on corporate crime or personhood or corporations?
I hope you will join me on Guy Fawkes Day on November 5th, assuming that he is elected, in starting the effort to really push this guy in a progressive direction. Because I think, you know, much like, you know, as you well know, Franklin Roosevelt, his first official act in office was actually to cut pensions for war orphans and widows.
Yeah.
I mean, he was elected as a conservative, and he got it, that the country did not want to be governed that way.
That's right. But you see, the liberals in those days knew how to put pressure on presidents. The liberals and progressives are not making any demands. Just look at 20 websites of 20 groups, environment, consumer, labor, anti-poverty, civil rights on the web that are supporting Obama, and see, they're not making any demands whatsoever. That's the difference between liberals today and in the 1930s. And also, organized labor isn't making demands.
Starting 9 days from now, I think we need to change that, don't you, Ralph?
Oh, we certainly will. And that's why a vote for Nader Gonzalez, instead of piling on a landslide for Obama, will produce a stronger hammer and a watchdog in Washington, not only for what we want to do to hold Washington's feet to the fire, but what all those citizen groups that people send $25, $50 to, the environmental and consumer labor, all these civil rights groups will do. I mean, it really is wasting your vote. In a place like New York, which I think Obama is ahead by like 34 points, Massachusetts, 28 points, Connecticut, 26 points, California, who knows what that is. It's just wasting your vote. You've got to support a third political force, which is what I've been saying all over. And last Saturday in 21 towns in one day, making the Guinness Book of Records.
You set the Guinness Book of World Records for the most speeches in a 24-hour period. We're talking with Ralph Nader. VoteNader.org is his website. Did you do that did you set out to break a Guinness Book record, or did you just happen to give that many speeches and it did it?
No, we did. We wanted to have a Guinness Book of Records. We wanted to provide a contrast to hundreds of millions of dollars McCain and Obama are dumping in these silly 30-second ads. What a waste. And, you know, we went through one town after another, farmers markets and libraries and places where people congregate, real people, right. Working class people, and they've never seen any presidential campaign before. And of course, in all the slam dunk McCain and Obama states, the majority of the American people won't see McCain or Obama, which is what the Electoral College does to politics in our country. But we established the Guinness Book of Records, but more important, we made a statement for community campaigning on the ground, not virtual reality and the internet or celluloid campaigning via television ads that have no content.
Yeah, we're talking with Ralph Nader. VoteNader.org is website. Ralph, it seems to me that we have a series of crises in the United States. You've talked about the two-party rule. Instant runoff voting is the law in over 300 communities around the United States. In virtually in every case, the largest being San Francisco, in virtually every case, it was the result of efforts by third parties, mostly the Green Party. I think probably all of them, maybe not all of them, but close. Two quick questions. One, what can we do? What's, in your mind, the most effective way to post-election, to build, whether McCain or Obama gets elected, or if you get elected, post-election, what's the most effective way to build a progressive movement that resembles that of the late 19th and early 20th century that actually can get things done? And number two, what kind of damage will it do to America if John McCain, if the Republicans are successful in stealing this election, if they, you know, in 2004 they disenfranchised 3 million people, 3 million people showed up to vote and were not allowed to vote. This year it'll probably be 5, 6, maybe 7 million people. What if McCain actually gets elected?
You won't believe the landslide proportions that are building up. I mean, McCain's behind in Virginia by 8 points and slipping. Virginia. North Carolina, he may very well lose. Here's the most important thing we can do.
But that's in the
Congress,
polls.
Congress is the most powerful branch of government, even right. though they may not know it constitutionally. What we need in every congressional district, which has about 600,000 people and colleges and community colleges, is 2,000 people in each congressional district, and this is what we've been talking about all over the country, to get together in a very serious pursuit of 10 or 12 long overdue national goals, full health insurance for all, living wage, shrinking the wasteful voluntary budget, getting rid of corporate subsidies, cracking down on corporate crime against consumers, et cetera, all of which is on our webpage issues button, votenator.org. They get together, and they do two things. They pledge 200 volunteer hours a year each, and they raise enough money which would be about $200 each, for three offices in every congressional district with a full-time person to provide the continuity. Then they zero in on their two senators and representatives, and they basically say, look, it's over, fellas. Huh? It's over. We are organized. Our positions are supported by a majority of your constituents. Here's the ultimatum, and we're not going to go one at a time.
We're going to go for
an 18-month progressive revolution in Connecticut, in Congress.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. We have about a half a minute here, Ralph. You know, I'm on the board or the advisory board of Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org.
Yeah.
There's the Green Party. There's the organizations that you've started. Do you see an umbrella organization, or are you going to lead one?
We're going to help facilitate these Congress action groups in each congressional district. We've had enthusiastic support for it. But progressive Democrats, you can be in the millions if you don't make demands, because you're so freaked out by the Republicans. If you don't make demands on the Democrats, prepare to be very disappointed by Barack Obama.
It's time to start raising hell, taking names and kicking ass, as they say.
That's right.
Absolutely the case. Ralph Nader, VoteNader.org is his website. Ralph, will you please keep us up to date on what you're doing after the election?
Thanks again, Tom, and thank you, Air America listeners.
You're welcome. You're always welcome here, Ralph. Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com. Fresh opinions and news you can use. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you. Like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my.
You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. My. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, we're taking our country back one congressional district at a time. Jill Morgenthaler on the line with us, former Illinois Homeland Security Advisor. She began her military career in 1976, served 10 months in Iraq, was awarded the Bronze Star for her service, was a peacekeeper in Bosnia, earned her the Humanitarian Service Medal for her work with Kosovar refugees in 98. She's also served in South Korea and Germany. A small businesswoman and also a colonel, if I have that right.
You sure do.
I do. Colonel Morgenthaler, welcome to our program. And you are now running as a Democrat in the 6th District, the 6th Congressional District of Illinois, against Republican incumbent Peter Roskin.
Correct.
So tell us about, first of all, the 6th Congressional District.
Well, it used to be Henry Hyde's old district. And what we saw 2 years ago when Major Tammy Duckworth ran against Peter Roskam, she only lost by 2 points, less than 5,000 votes. The whole district's been turning, and it has turned really fast in these last 2 years. 46,000 more Democratic people have registered, and during the primary, more Democrats voted than Republicans, first time since ever. And then in my own race, which is really based on common sense and doing the smart thing, I've got both Republicans and Democrats helping me win this race.
That's great. We're talking with Jill Morgenthaler. Her website is, I've lost it. Hang on just a second. Here it is, JillMorgenthaler.com. Hey, surprise, MorgenThaler.com, JillMorgenthaler.com for Congress in 08. And, Jill, what do you see as the biggest issues?
Oh, it's definitely the economy. I've been, going to the train stations, going to the houses, and everyone is just stressed. You just see it in their faces. And, of course, what they're very upset about is the fact that we've let deregulation, take away our own incomes from our 401ks. We've seen small businesses finding credit just tightening up, and they're about to go under. And my opponent has just been taking corporate big dollars from them on his contribution, and basically he has not represented the people at all, and they're furious.
Yeah. And the economy, education, the environment. I see on your website, education, the environment, healthcare. I mean, right on down the list. It seems like in virtually every area, this Republican administration, the Republicans in the House and the Senate, the Republican that you're running against, Peter Roskam, we're talking with Jill Morgenthaler, JillMorgenthaler.com, her website, have really been harming this country. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, and, you know, Tom, he's also more than just, you know, being part of the Republican Party. He's actually one of those very far right-wing extremists, and that's one reason why I stood up. He actually is trying to censor what our soldiers and Marines can read and buy in the PXs. You know, here we rely on them to keep our freedom, and he's going to turn around and tell them that they can't read Maxim magazine or watch The Sopranos.
Oh, wow. Oh, so he's one of those right-wingers who is Maxim magazine sometimes has women in bikinis, I guess, and things like that, that he's a right-wing prude. Is that I don't, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't, you know, we don't have a good word for it, I guess. You know, just these hysterical people. And that's not even a porno magazine. I mean, it's just a motorcycle driving guys magazine kind of thing, I guess. So this is amazing. The incumbent Peter Roskam, what does he vote with Bush virtually all the time?
Yes, 93% of the time, and then he has those some other extreme votes out there. He actually is trying to give human fertilized eggs full legal protection, which means a woman could not have an abortion even in cases of rape or the life in danger. And it would also bring an end to in vitro fertilization because a woman would have to carry all the eggs or find other women to do it. So that 7% is just way out there.
Wow. Wow. I mean, that is over the top because after in vitro fertilization, there are leftover fertilized eggs, and typically they're washed down the drain. And he wants to classify them as human beings. I'm guessing, though, he doesn't want to give them nationalized health insurance.
No. His health program is you get what you afford. And he basically wants to remove businesses from providing health care. I mean, you know, he's accepted, you know, millions from health insurance companies, tobacco industry, et cetera. And when I talk to small businesses, they do want to provide health care, but they'd like the freedom of being able to purchase and pool together across state lines. So to me, that's a very practical solution we can do.
We're talking with retired Colonel Jill Morgenthaler. Jill Morgenthaler, MorgenThaler.com is her website. If you want to see another congressional district, we need as many as we can get. Flip from the R to the D category. Get over to her website and toss a few bucks her way. Help her out. Jill, are you looking for volunteers in Illinois? We're on the air in Chicago.
Yes, absolutely. I could use volunteers. We've been doing rallies. We're doing walks. We're doing telephone calls. And to be honest, I could use contributions. Roskam's raised over $1 million. He's using it to campaign a real smear campaign against my honorable career. So anything anybody can contribute online would be a big help for me.
That's great. Jill Morgenthaler, the website, Jill, MorgenThaler.com. She's running in the 6th District of Illinois against Republican incumbent Peter Roskam, one of the real bad guys. Jill, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
And good luck on your campaign. And thank you so much for being willing to step out and campaign. That's a huge step. Thank you. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, I'll be debating Dr. Yaron Brook about the next potential crisis to face America, food shortages. Also, what does he think about Alan Greenspan? Plus, we'll challenge conservative economist Stephen Moore about his opinions on the economy and his book, The End of Prosperity. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com. Stay tuned for Doing Time with Ron Kuby, coming up next on AirAmerica.com.